Welcome to Fire Your Therapist, a podcast with a radical perspective on mental health. Here are your hosts, Carrie and Dan.
Welcome to Fire Your Therapist. On this episode, Carrie and I are going to have a foursome with Russell Brand and heroin.
Oh, foursome. Well, like the heroin is an extra person.
It is. It's a whole personality.
How do you do that on air?
We'll just, you know, we'll get the mics up really close. We'll make sure all the sounds get captured.
That is disgusting.
I haven't thought that far ahead.
I hope people didn't turn off the podcast because they're just put off by what you just said.
Everybody loves Russell Brand. We just gained 10 listeners.
I don't know. I don't know. I didn't even know who Russell Brand was by name. I knew his face until I came across this article we're going to talk about today. I don't know. What an opener, Dan. Excuse me, everybody in our listening audience. I'm very sorry, and I apologize for Dan's behavior. He is still in the developmentally, what is that, the phallic stage?
Very. Very phallic.
Just pretend you're listening to a 12-year-old girl talk about psychology.
Come on, 16. Give me a little bit of credit.
Okay.
I can drive.
Until you lose your license for having a foursome on air. Okay.
I won't do it while driving. Come on. Harm reduction.
I meant you. Never mind. Anyway, today we're going to talk about an article that has been recently going around Facebook. It's not a new article, but first we're going to check in, and then we'll bring it up. We are not going to talk about having a foursome, but we are going to talk about Russell Brand, conveniently. Dan, is there anything that you want to check in about before we have a very enlightening conversation on this topic?
I think I would like to just check in and say that harm reduction is a pretty controversial topic. If anybody listening didn't know that.
Oh, harm reduction. That's what we're talking about. And no idea from that intro.
Yes. Yes. That is what we're talking about today. If people have strong feelings about the side of this issue that we come in on, I encourage them to contact us, even though I will very obviously have a very specific stance that I take on issues about substance use.
Okay.
And foursomes.
Okay. Anything else?
No, I'm good. All right. How are you?
I am coming off of a cold, so I'm going to check in with, I sound a little raspy, and that's to be expected. Forgive me.
But maybe it's sexy like Marge's sisters on The Simpsons. Maybe it sounds good when your voice is like... That's like an old Jewish woman. I don't even know what that is.
Maybe they were Jewish. Maybe they were. Were the Simpsons Jewish? I don't know. I
think the Simpsons were Jewish.
But we digress. Okay. Are we ready to go?
Keep going.
All right. We'll go right into it. Yeah, that's all my check-in is. Okay, so this article I'm talking about...
Yes, I understand.
Was actually sent to me by my sister.
You have a lot to say about this.
I have a lot to say about this. I shouldn't say sent to me. My sister posted it online. It inspired me to bring up this topic of harm reduction. The article was released over a year ago. I don't know why it's making a comeback online, but people are interested. It was published in The Spectator magazine. It was written by Russell Brand. It's called Russell Brand on Heroin, Abstinence, and Addiction. Apparently, he opened a whole foundation to help people enter into an abstinence-only model of getting sober. And I just have so many things to say, but I want to read a little bit of it that we have some material to talk about.
Okay.
He starts out by saying that he has an experience that is stressful to him. So a woman tells him that she's pregnant and it's not his. And so he says, I had to take immediate action. And that the last time he thought about taking heroin when it was yesterday. So this is like a recurring theme for him. This is something that he reaches for to use, I don't know, regularly, or it's just a constant thought of something that he could do. I don't know how regularly he uses. He doesn't really say at this time that he's writing. But he says, I had to take immediate action. I put Morrissey on in my car, and as I wound my way through the neurotic Hollywood Hills, my misery burgeoned. Soon, I could no longer see where I ended and the pain began, so now I had a choice. He says, I cannot accurately convey the efficiency of heroin in neutralizing pain. And then he goes on to talk about what it's like to take heroin. He says, it transforms a tight white fist into a gentle brown wave, and from my first inhalation 15 years ago, it fumigated my private hell. The bathroom floor in Hackney embraced me like a womb, and now whenever I'm dislodged from comfort, my focus falls there. So it's something like he's referencing, he's always going back to as a support, right? Mm-hmm. So he goes on in the article to talk about how hard it is for him to not use heroin, to not use anything. And I just like, I have a lot of thoughts come up for me throughout the article, but is there anything that like from the beginning sparked your interest at all?
Well, I'm struck by how nostalgic his description of the use is.
Mm-hmm.
Not because I think that's strange. I actually think a lot of folks that identify as an addict hold that nostalgia for their use, which I actually think is problematic to the abstinence-only model because it vilifies something that people have a lot of nostalgia for, and that sets up a very polarized dichotomy that seems far too rigid to be empowering or supportive for that many people. But what struck you about what you said at the beginning there?
Well, you know what? Before I talk about that, you're saying nostalgia. Stay on the same topic. He says later in the article, he says he watched a video of himself using because he was going to write. He was in a more sober place and he wanted to like see what it was like for him back when he was using. He watches a video and he says, I was surprised that my reaction was not one of gratitude for the positive changes I've experienced. Instead, I felt envious of this earlier version of myself, unencumbered by the burden of abstinence.
Yeah.
The burden. Yeah. I think that stood out to me. You're talking about nostalgia. Are we on the same topic?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So here's what piques my interest. So he still has a feeling of nostalgia or longing to use, which tells me that the longing is still unsupported and that he has found no support to replace the longing to use. Yet in the beginning, the very beginning of the article, he said, he didn't say, oh, I was craving heroin at the moment that this girl told me she's pregnant and the baby's not mine. No, he said, she told me she's pregnant, the baby's not mine, and then I had to choose. And then I felt like I have to take action, I have to do something, I have to get high. And what struck me is this is contextually based. So something happened in your context and you needed to support the arousal you were feeling in that moment. So now I'm like, okay, I'm anxious, I'm scared, I'm in pain, I'm nervous, whatever the experience was for him. He had a moment where he got to choose what he was going to reach for. And so I guess my issue with abstinence only is that the only thing you're allowed to reach for is stop, like don't use.
Right, you're not allowed to reach for an underlying healthy longing and a different support. Instead, it's just shamed. Don't want that, don't crave it, don't reach for it, don't think about it. The only way to be a good person is to shame yourself and encourage others to support that shame, to sort of psychologically beat you out of a thing that you want.
Yeah.
Hence, leaving it nostalgic.
Yeah. Okay. I want to hear your response to this, Dan. He says, unless they have structured help, they have no hope. Now, that can be interpreted many ways.
Mm-hmm.
I actually disagree with structured help because I think what he's saying is an abstinence-only program, right? Okay. As the structured help.
Yeah.
But in like the next paragraph, he says, his answer is, don't pick up a drug. It's one day at a time. It sounds so simple, and actually, it is simple, but it isn't easy.
Right.
I argue with simple, too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a really loaded thing that he said in the article just there. Two really big things come to mind. First, the structured part. Of course you need structure. Everything in life needs structure and community and context and support. The second part about how it's so simple highlights why that structure is needed. The oversimplification is horribly oppressive.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's one rule. It's nearly inhumane. It's impossible to live up to and unsustainable unless you have an oppressive structure to keep you on it.
Okay. Like, what kind of oppressive structure are you talking about?
An abstinence-only program.
How is that oppressive, though? Because aren't they trying to do good, like by helping you to stop whatever it is you want to stop?
I think debating the intention is a separate issue. Because I think everybody in an abstinence-only program is well-intended.
Okay. Everybody, the clients or the...
Both. Okay. I mean, we could throw out all sorts of cliches about where intention takes us, but...
The road of good intentions.
Yeah, exactly. Right. No, exactly. But that really highlights how the model for abstinence only is not one that's sustainably implemented without a ton of support.
Okay, so here's what we should talk about. He's talking about support, and I think he's talking about it in the way of you get a sponsor or a friend you can call when you're having a weak moment or you're at a choice point and you don't trust yourself. Mm-hmm. Or you check into rehab. By the way, is rehab useful? I mean, 97% of programs use abstinence only. Only one third of the people are successful. That means 66% of people in abstinence only programs are not successful. That's like an incredible moneymaker.
Yeah, that's a good statistic. It's similar to the one that I often use when I do training, which is the same number for abstinence only, 97%. Uh-huh. But of those, and this is important to hear how I say this, of those that stick with it, meaning not just anybody who peeks their head into one abstinence-only meeting of some kind and then disappears, but of those who stick with it, it's successful for about 25 to 30%.
Okay.
So it's the same sort of 60-some-odd percent you just said, but I think it's important to note that there's so much self-select there. They're only even calling out that percentage amongst folks who pass the barrier of... this is at least an appealing intervention for me, so I'm going to stay with it.
Right, I'm willing and I want it.
Right. So if already that's a small number, maybe a third, and then what's happening to all the folks that encounter that model, find it oppressive, find the religious portion of it doesn't align with their own values for some reason, find that the culture of those meetings... I'm not a long-time participant in abstinence-only meetings, but I've gone to a number of AA meetings of various types, and the culture of it is particular. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm saying it is a specific culture. So there's some barriers to even getting consistently in the door. And then if you're only measuring amongst those folks that get consistently in the door and stick with it, it works for them.
So you're saying there's a high barrier to get in.
There is a high barrier, but the flip side of it is the bigger point. If we know from those statistics, and even I was really actually happy that Russell Brand mentioned at some point in the article, he says 90% of you are probably reading this and thinking it sounds crazy. Mm-hmm. Doesn't say it exactly like that. Mm-hmm. But he says that's because 90% of you have no problem with this.
Yeah.
And he's very pro-abstinence only, and he's essentially saying, yes, 90% of the population, this model doesn't work for.
Uh-huh.
So why are 97% of the programs abstinence only?
Uh-huh.
We've really got a big incongruence there. If the vast majority of the population, this doesn't work for.
Right, right.
I mean, I think the counter argument would be, well, they're not addicts. Why would they need this service? But I think both of us could take a different kind of issue with that, which is we're all dependent on various things.
Yeah.
Some things get vilified, some things don't.
Right.
Some things lead to greater dysfunction than others. I mean...
Well, here's what he says in the article. He says, drugs are not his problem. Reality is his problem. And drugs were the solution.
I love that quote, too. I love that quote.
He said drugs were the solution.
Yeah.
Solution to what? To get rid of the pain. He says it pretty clearly in the article that... he was in pain. He was trying to escape it. Once he was high, there was no girl. There was no tomorrow. And he's no longer thinking about what happened. So, you know, if he was here, I would imagine that he would say the solution was to escape what I was in. So it's like escape for him. It might be something else for someone else who's using, right? Maybe they're looking to feel something, you know, rather than to escape a feeling. Anyway, you can go on that road forever, but my point is that he's reaching for something to support the pain or to escape the pain. So we should have a conversation about that kind of support. And that, yes, of course, using drugs could support a stressful experience in a relationship. But other people turn to other things, which might point to their availability of resources. This guy's a celebrity. He could probably easily get drugs, whereas other people may not be able to.
Right.
So access is one thing, but he has access to lots of resources. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if the question is, if he's at that choice point, then what else could he be supporting the pain with? And are they talking about that in an abstinence-only program? I don't know.
Right. And what does that say? And this is a question to you, but also just a question to anybody listening. What does that say about our culture?
What do you mean?
If the conversation is not about the underlying pain that leads to coping strategies that have problems, which is my way of saying what they're calling addiction,
mm-hmm.
right? If the conversation is not about the underlying issues that lead to those coping strategies,
mm-hmm.
the underlying right. pain, the right. unresolved conflicts, etc.
Different not contextual.
Not that they can be completely resolved, but they can be supported.
Right. They can be different factors in his context.
Right, right. If there's no conversation about those, and so many people can get on board with agreeing that, no, the problem really is they're just an addict.
Uh-huh, they're sick.
Pull
they
the
have
curtain
a disease.
On that underlying pain. Let's just call them an addict and give them a really oppressive program to make them conform so that we don't have to think about that pain. What is that? Like, I know it's a bit of a big philosophical question, but what does that say about our culture if we're so committed to hiding that pain
yeah.
that we will have 97% of the programs out there abstinence only, even though
mm-hmm.
that doesn't match how the vast majority of humans function healthily?
Okay, and Russell Brand, he says he was successful in this program, right? In an abstinence-only model. He went on to start a foundation to help other people, you know, go through what he went through. He found it so useful, and he does emphasize a compassionate approach in abstinence-only. He says that's essential.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to start this thing in a way that made people feel like addicts were not bad people, and right. to take the stigma out of that and make it more right. like, well, they're just sick. So, okay, yes, I understand the compassionate approach. And I like, you know, God bless his heart, because he wants to not vilify these people. I get it.
Totally.
And by these people, I mean, like, you know, everybody that we know that uses on to any degree.
Totally.
But he's going for a medical model, and that this is a sickness or a disease, right. and that this is the only approach. It's so rigid
yeah.
that I think he's totally collapsing all the complexity here, that it's not a one-size-fits-all. And there's also a part where in the article he says, oh, I remember this one time when I was using and I was in Hackney. And then another time he says, oh, yeah. And then another time I was using, I was in another Hackney flat. He says, Hackney is starting to seem like part of the problem. Oh,
the context.
Your context is part yeah. of the problem. Yeah. So what if you weren't in Hackney? Would you be tempted? Right. Is it a support for you to be out of that place?
Right.
You know? And when you're back there, are you can you manage your supports in a way that abstinence is not the only option?
Right.
And when you're feeling right. pain, you have 25 things to reach for and not just drugs. Yeah, I don't know.
And I want to clarify for our listeners that when you say abstinence isn't the only option, you don't mean using harmful substances routinely is necessarily good. You just mean there's pragmatism in there. And there's
right.
a spectrum of exploring what's supportive and what's not supportive that should come before a rigid, oppressive dogma.
Right. Okay, so here's how I would say it. If someone came to a psychotherapy appointment and they said, I'm using heroin, Carrie, I want to stop, I would be like, well, first, I really want to know what is great about using heroin before we talk about doing anything.
Right.
And I know that sounds really, I don't know, backwards or controversial, or someone would be like, oh, you're using reverse psychology. No.
Right.
I want to get to know it, because the more we know about it, we'll know what it is supporting for you.
Right.
Because if I just withdraw that, then that's when you get the relapse from these programs that are so
shameful.
Successful, right? Oh, yeah, and shameful. Yeah. Can we talk about the language that they use?
Well, that's what came up for me in the description of his program. Even though, yes, he calls it a compassionate program,
mm-hmm.
it's laden with a couple big clues that pop out for me about how that might be a mixed message. right? So mm-hmm. he says compassion, but he also acknowledges that the culture of the support system is very secretive. He doesn't use the word secretive. Private.
Private, yeah. Very, he says it's essential, basically.
Very private, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So doesn't that reinforce that it's somehow bad? It's somehow morally bad and shameful because it has to be private. You wouldn't dare...
Right, let anybody know. Let the
support be, right, something known.
I mean, and then put it in that context. If you're in the context where no one can know,
right,
then how much support could you possibly have? I mean, obviously, there's the shame of judgment that you might encounter. Let's say you're sharing with your family, oh, I'm using again, and you have a history, and they're like, ugh.
Right.
No, like, we just paid for rehab 3.5 times, and, you know, here you are again, and, like, you know, you have to face that disappointment or the judgment or the ridicule, the shame. Yet, if you're not having a dialogue about it, then you're going to go into self-isolation. You're going to practice isolation. Right. And then, really, what are the supports you have? You have drugs. You might get to the point where that's the only support you can reach for. Because you'd rather do that than face the shame. Because the shame is actually, like, overpowering. I can understand that. I can get behind the fact of wanting to isolate. But I don't think it's right. sustainable. Because then you'll fall back on the only support you can see as an option.
Totally. And I think that shame doesn't just paralyze folks that see themselves as addicts. I think it also indirectly paralyzes therapists, social uh-huh. workers, other helping professionals.
Yeah. And the support for the people, like the friends and the family,
right.
they're in their mind, they've absolutely. Only heard of abstinence
absolutely.
Only.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the things that you are giving examples of how you might start a conversation are off the table.
Right.
They're immediately brushed aside. And I think there's a lot of confusion for helping professionals specifically, probably for friends and family also, that empathy mm-hmm. endorses a behavior. And so if you empathize with the benefits and the supports of substance use, you're thereby, you know, those horrible words people use, like enabling.
Oh, right.
Right. Such if I'm like, patronizing
wow.
words.
If I say, wow, looks like heroin's like really doing something for you.
Right. Right.
Then I'm enabling rather than saying this is supporting you in one way or another. Let's figure out what it's supporting.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's interesting to think about like a spectrum from vilifying to pitying to sympathy to empathy, right? If we like, I hope that makes sense sort of as a spectrum,
mm-hmm.
right? And Russell Brand is definitely making a case for moving away from vilifying as they're bad people and into...
Which I'm on board with, and absolutely. And into
they're just sick, which honestly sounds like pity.
It kind of does.
It's not maybe getting close to sympathy, but it's definitely not empathy, right? Because the big hurdle between any of those and true empathy
mm-hmm.
is I can feel that that's reasonable.
Right.
I know enough about your experience of this that it feels reasonable.
Uh-huh.
And I can honor and empower your reach for that support because it's reasonable.
Reasonable. Not necessarily
reasonable isn't good. A good or bad judgment.
It's just reasonable yeah. considering the exactly. context, considering exactly. the options you feel that you have.
Exactly. And I truly believe that if somebody struggling with something that there's a lot of shame for finds a story that makes that struggle reasonable,
uh-huh.
then the shame around honoring the underlying need suddenly gets some power back, rather than I can't look at the underlying need because the behavior I do on top of it is bad and wrong. So the whole, like, what's the expression? Throw mm-hmm. the baby out with the bathwater, right? The
yeah.
whole thing gets thrown out. I'm not allowed to look at the underlying need because it's in this package of a thing that I'm not supposed to want.
Uh-huh.
But if we honor, you are supposed to want it. It's reasonable.
Yeah. For where like, you're if I was from. Going through what you're going through, exactly. I would want to get high too.
Right. Right.
And so, like, what can yeah. we support yeah. the longing to get high with that's not drugs? Or are you using reasonably in a way that's not harming you or anyone else? Because people right. do use in amounts. I don't know if I would put it on any sort of spectrum of appropriate because when it comes into the harder drugs, we know the significant damage it can do to our bodies.
Right.
And to the people around us and to our communities.
Right.
But in this article, he's building it up to the point where he said the only way that he can beat his disease or sickness is constant vigilance. And that sounds exhausting to me.
It does sound exhausting.
And completely unsustainable. He says the disease of addiction is not rational. And I was like, yeah, maybe not rational. Maybe you might want to do drugs because, like, you know, you had some sort of a temptation when you were, like, on your way walking to work or something, and you smelled something and there was a memory triggered and now you want to get high in this moment and you know what's wrong. And you're like, oh, this disease is not rational. I am a victim to it. But right. You know what? Maybe I would disagree that it's not. Well, I don't know. Maybe I agree with him that it isn't rational. But is it reasonable?
Exactly the distinction I was thinking of. I think our culture is so caught up with this rational, irrational comparison. You know, if you look at economics and politics, there's all of these discourses about being a rational consumer, being a rational decision maker,
mm-hmm.
right? And we confuse that with what's reasonable for a situation. Because the two are very, very different in some ways,
mm-hmm.
right? The rational, irrational thing is a comparison to something that has been normed for a specific social expectation or culture or something.
It comes straight out of an abstinence-only model. And the idea that's rational.
That is the culture that is constructed, exactly.
Yeah, and it's rational to want to take care of our bodies. And it's like, I don't know.
Right, and when we use the word reasonable, we're simply referring to, does it make sense for the context and the experience? I'm really glad you brought up the constant vigilance thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think a big underlying piece of this that may go unacknowledged a lot of time is trauma.
Oh, yeah.
And what he's describing is hypervigilance.
Uh-huh.
Which is a very common and expected side effect of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not simply meaning PTSD. I think people oversimplify trauma. You know, I think the best definition I could give is anything in life, whether it's prolonged or acute, that uh-huh. forces us to no longer take for granted what we should be able to take for granted. And I don't use shoulds very often, but like I can walk down the street and not get assaulted, right? That's a should that we'd all like to try to carry around, right?
Uh-huh.
So once things happen in someone's life enough that they can't take it for granted, and their neurology has to rewire to deal with reality in this new way, I think it's safe to call that trauma, maybe lowercase t trauma,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense to anybody. But that's what that hypervigilance is. And if nobody is talking about having to live with hypervigilance,
right,
and about the possible underlying trauma, but they are pushing all of this shame-based, oppressive, abstinence only, it just seems, I mean, I'm going to say unethical.
It does feel unethical. I'm going to say, okay, so drug use, alcohol was supporting you to stay out of maybe a hypervigilant state, and we're just going to pull that rug out from under you.
Right.
And say, get used to not using.
Right.
And I know in abstinence-only models, they are addressing trauma and context to a certain degree. But the supports that are available, I don't know about phone a friend. I don't know about staying in rehab as a consistent, sustainable support.
Because without the substance to regulate, you end up with, you know, probably fluctuations between anxiety and depression.
Well, what you have is unsupported arousal.
Right, exactly.
When you're hypervigilant, and that's dangerous.
Exactly.
Because let's say that the support that you need is not there in that moment, but you know exactly how to get high, or you have it in your house, or you have it
right.
down the street, or whatever the situation may be, and you haven't built the supports. I think that's what's sustainable about harm reduction, is you're actively trying to build supports to take the place of the thing you don't want to do. And then when those supports are built, like you have a community.
Right.
You have alternative activities.
Right.
You have ways of filling your time that doesn't have anything to do with using. And sometimes it is a phone a friend support, if that's what works for you. But I think if that's not sustainable for you, you got to build other things. I don't know if abstinence only is including those other things.
Right.
It sounds like a pretty rigid model. I know sometimes it's also spiritually based, and that turns a lot of people off from wanting to get help that way. You know? It's like, I don't want to go in and say a prayer at the end of every meeting because that doesn't jive with me.
Right.
So,
right. And I mean, personally, I'm not very religious. And the only part of that that turns me off is the immediate giving up of power.
Hmm. How do you mean?
it's a disease and you have no control over it,
uh-huh,
is like the first mantra when you walk in the door.
Usually, yeah. And you know what? What hits me wrong is the article that I'm reading by Russell Brand. He's using a lot of language like get clean or I was in the gutter. And these are ways that we refer to right. drug use, and we yep. often say drug abuse as if yep. someone's like,
and it I'm going to abuse myself on purpose. I really want shame.
Yeah, it reinforces it, and it really makes the situation very black and white. You're either clean or you're dirty, right? You're like, what are we saying by saying we're not clean? We're saying we're dirty, we're filthy, mm-hmm. we're bad. We're in the gutter. I mean, like, how low can you get if that's how you're referring to yourself? He refers to himself that way in the article. So if he's been through a rehab program, it worked for him, great. But there's such self-abusing language that he came out with.
Right.
So, I mean, how compassionate can you be for yourself, really, in your situation? You can call yourself a victim and at the same time say that you're bad, dirty, and in the gutter? I'm like, there's something not linking up there for me. I don't know if I can get on board with it.
Right. And how much does he go into, because he tells that story about filling a hole, right? How much does he go into what that hole is for him and what support he got for that? And was part of his process learning to identify the underlying feelings? I mean, I'm sorry to sound like a fifth grade teacher, but, you know, something was skipped in the evolution of how he knows how to receive support from others. That why didn't that story that led off the beginning of the article go something like, I got this news, it was really hard to deal with, I immediately called a friend or went to a family member's house or had somewhere to go and discuss this difficult feeling I had.
Mm-hmm.
Where's that in the story? So there's a huge community of support that will shame him away from using substances, but apparently calling one of them to talk about this wasn't the first thing. I mean, I'm sure he has people to talk to about it.
Right.
But it wasn't the first thing he led with in the story, and I think that tells us something.
Well, what he's saying in the story is that, what he's not saying in the story is that he had anyone anywhere near him. So, I mean, it's kind of pointing to some social isolation already. I mean, he has celebrity status, so I sort of imagine, like, there's a certain amount of private life where right. you can't easily, like, leave your house and go see your friend, you know, people are following you around, that kind of thing. I can't relate to what it's like to be a celebrity and to live that kind of life. And I've heard it's quite crazy. So I don't know. I think maybe we can wrap up and I'm going to check out with the compassion that I have for his situation, and that I don't quite understand what it would be like to have that sort of status in the world and to be combating something that anyone, you know, in with my type of lifestyle would be combating.
Right.
The resources would certainly be different. The options would be different. And I also want to check out with the fact that, like, rehab programs are quite expensive. And so it's something he has access to and right. that he's pushing in an article in The Spectator that not only celebrities are reading. Like, the average Joe is reading. And he's like, that's nice you went to rehab, buddy. And it's nice you're trying to get funding for people. But what's the likelihood I can even access it? So
right. It's not a sustainable resource.
Yeah. It's just, I think the barrier is far too high.
Right.
Is there anything you want to check out with Dan, or anything lingering that you felt it was important to address before we end today?
Yeah, there is one thing I want to say. And I have compassion for his struggle too, without a doubt. I hope everybody can hear that our perspective is both critical and very compassionate. But the thing I want to say is that for every celebrity that has a public story about rehab,
mm-hmm.
which is a very safe story for a celebrity, right? You can say it's not my fault. You can say, don't make me look like a bad person. I had this problem. I went to this expensive place. I'm all better now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a safer and easier to manage story. But for every celebrity that has that story, there are thousands of social workers and community agencies that tell a much different story that isn't in the news because it's not celebrities. Right. So if you talk to people that work with homeless youth that do tons of meth, if you talk to people who are, you know, multiply diagnosed and struggling with HIV positive, Hep C, like, you go into these communities where it's not just I had enough money to afford a really hard drug and I became an addict, but I have never had the money. I've lived on the streets. I do nothing but 18 different drugs and barely eat. And even in those extreme situations where I think the abstinence-only perspective would often say, well, that's exactly why we have to be abstinence-only. Look what it's doing to these people. The people working in those contexts will have a perspective closer to a harm reduction one than an abstinence-only one, because they've seen that struggle and they've seen that the thing that helps long-term sustainable change when you, sort of, as you were saying, don't have the money for these very well-structured, very well-fortified resources is community values that hold each other in the underlying pain, because that's the missing piece.
Yeah, well said. I feel kind of bad that we're like putting Russell Brand out there and using him as an example. I'm sorry, I guess celebrities are usually used as an example. This is just a really enlivening article for me. And because it was going around on the internet and I didn't see any harm reduction stance in response to this, I'm hoping that, you know, people understand that we hold abstinence-only model under the umbrella of harm reduction as one of the options that does work for people.
Right.
It might need to have a softened edge, but some right. people eat it up. They use it once. It works. They never do drugs again. It's just what the doctor ordered for them. And the disease model is something that really, like, fits in with their working model of the world. And that's great for them. I don't think it applies to all.
Right.
So we could go into harm reduction on so many different levels and talk about everything that falls under the umbrella. So please send us your questions. If you listen to this episode, anything came up for you, you can email us at feedback@fireyourtherapistshow.com. You can tweet us at FYT Show, or you can also like us on Facebook at FYT Show. We really want to thank each and every one of you for listening. It means a lot to us for you to, you know, listen to what we're talking about and sending your answers and your reviews. It gives us material to bring up on future shows, so we really encourage you. And thank you so much to Yumi Media, our sponsor and our producer. Fire Your Therapist is brought to you by Yumi Media. Yumi Media offers a very custom production solution with quite intentional design. I can say for myself that when we started Fire Your Therapist, we really only had an idea. We approached Yumi Media, they took care of everything else, everything. They designed our logos, they put us on iTunes, made a website, they made it possible for us to not only record the audio, but they brought the equipment. And although we're a small-scale production based in Los Angeles, you know, Yumi Media is based in Los Angeles, so it's not only convenient for us, but I know that they work overseas. They travel for different, you know, large-scale productions like conferences. They bring everything, lighting, video, audio, photography, anything that you would need for any sort of production or conference, they bring it. And then when they're done, they do post-production, editing, audio, video, everything. You really only need to have an idea. So if you have a project that you're looking to work on, please contact Yumi Media. Send in your questions and they'll let you know how that they can work with you in a very custom way that fits exactly what you're trying to do on your project. They really honor your ideas, and I think that that's the best part about them. Please contact them at info@yumimedia.com or go to their website, yumimedia.com, and that's spelled YOUMIMEDIA.com. You can also call them 310-989-0138.
Fire Your Therapist was produced by Yumi Media. Subscribe to our free podcast on iTunes or go to fireyourtherapistshow.com, where you can find podcasts, resources, and more.